This is Dauchi's Biology, recorded the 16th of February, 2022. Proteins. Isn't this the coolest way to study? You're out shopping with your AirPods in. Look around. Everyone who sees you thinks you're listening to some cool music. Well, let's let them think that, shall we? Just nod your head and tap your foot. I won't tell them what you're really listening to if you don't. It'll be our little secret. And in the meanwhile, let's study biology. This episode is all about proteins. Now, it might seem strange to devote a whole episode of the podcast just to talking about proteins. And if you're thinking that, I can understand why, but you'd be wrong because proteins are so incredibly important in biology. Not just important in Unit 3 for biology, that is not just important for your understanding in terms of doing well on the exam, but proteins are just important in biology. In fact, I'd go as far as saying that proteins are what life is all about. Life is made of proteins. And, you know, you might be thinking, well, what about DNA? You know, another biomacromolecule, surely DNA is the stuff of life. It's the molecule of life, surely. But really, I'd argue that proteins are more important than DNA because the whole purpose of DNA, the reason why DNA is even important, is because it's the coded instructions for building proteins. Other than that, it has no real importance. It's the coded instructions for making proteins. And so proteins are king. Proteins are the important thing. You know, it's a bit like saying what's, you know, what's more important, a recipe or a cake? You know, well, if all you have is recipes, you're going to starve. Cake is in some ways more important than recipes. The importance of the recipe is that it's the instructions for making the cake. But the cake is the end goal. The cake is the purpose of having those instructions in the first place. And really, that's the same as the relationship between DNA and proteins. It really would be impossible to overstate the importance of proteins in Unit 3 and 4 biology all year. From beginning to end, we're going to be learning about things that involve proteins. Carrier proteins and channel proteins in the plasma membrane are made of proteins. Antibodies are made of proteins, and most antigens that they stick on are also made of proteins. Enzymes are made of proteins, and enzymes right through Unit 3 and 4 biology. If you started looking at the TRIP operon, for example, you'll have learned about enzymes like anthranilate synthase and indole-3 glycerol phosphate synthase and tryptophan synthase. All of those are enzymes, which means they're all proteins. You know, even the RNA polymerase enzyme that transcribes the DNA is a protein. And the ribosome that reads the RNA is largely made of protein as well. As I said, you can't overstate the importance of proteins. And so to that end, I thought, you know, it's probably worth devoting a whole episode of the podcast to make sure that we've got a really good, solid understanding of what a protein is. Let me start by saying that proteins are made of amino acids. That's not as simple as it sounds, though, because you'll hear people saying that polypeptides are a polymer of amino acids, proteins are a polymer of amino acids. In fact, people often use the word protein and polypeptide interchangeably. You'll hear people talking and you know flip-flopping back and forth between the word protein and polypeptide as though it doesn't really matter which one of those words you use. They both really mean the same thing. And, you know, to some extent, that's kind of true-ish, but it's not really true. They're different words. They mean subtly different things. A polypeptide, when we say that something is a polypeptide, what we're saying is that it's a chain of amino acids, or it's a polymer of amino acids. That's what the word polypeptide means. When we say that something is a protein, what we mean is that it's a structure in the cell that does a job, and that it's made of at least one polypeptide, right? So all proteins are made of a polypeptide or several polypeptides, because many proteins are made of more than one polypeptide, but a lot of proteins are made of a single polypeptide. But even when a protein is made of one single polypeptide, still the word protein and polypeptide are slightly different. Okay, again, just to emphasize, I'm going to overemphasize it, but just to make sure you're clear on this, when we say that something is a polypeptide, we're talking really about its structure. We're saying that it's composed of a chain of amino acids. When we say that something is a protein, we're saying it has a job to do. It might be an enzyme or a carrier protein or something like that, an antibody. That's its job. It's a protein. But because that protein is made of at least one polypeptide, it's also true to say that proteins are made of amino acids, if you see what I mean there. All right, so let's start our conversation by talking about amino acids. If we've said that proteins are made of amino acids, proteins are made of at least one polypeptide, sometimes several polypeptides, together doing one job. But if they're made of amino acids, it's obviously a pretty important place to start to make sure that we understand amino acids. Now, every amino acid, an amino acid's a molecule, obviously, which means it's a bunch of atoms held together by covalent bonds, and every amino acid has several different parts, really four different parts. Or, from last episode, we could say different moieties, okay? Just to begin with, every amino acid has an alpha carbon, which is really just a carbon. It's got a hydrogen on it, but basically a carbon. And attached to that alpha carbon is a carboxyl group and an amino group and a side chain, okay? A carboxyl group, an amino group, and a side chain. A carboxyl group, as the name suggests, has carbon and oxygen in it. It also has hydrogen. But primarily, it has carbon and oxygen, carboxyl. A lot of the things in biology sound like really big words. Carboxyl, that sounds like a big word, right? But in reality, it's actually a very descriptive word. It's a helpful word. It tells us what the thing is. It's carboxyl, carbon and oxygen. As I said, there's hydrogen on the oxygen as well. The amino group is a nitrogen with a couple of hydrogens. All right, so just to summarize that so far, every amino acid has an alpha carbon with a carboxyl group, carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, and an amino group which has nitrogen and hydrogen. And every amino acid is exactly the same in that regard, okay? But then every amino acid also has one of 20 side chains. There are 20 different side chains to choose from, and they're all different. Some are big, some are small. Glycine, for example, is just a single hydrogen. Some are really, really big. Some are really small. Some are electrically positive. Some are electrically negative. Some are polar. Some are nonpolar. They've got all different chemical properties, but there are 20 different side chains. So when we talk about, you know, the different amino acids, you know, we talk about, you know, lysine and glutamic acid and tyrosine and, you know, all these different 20 different amino acids. The only difference from one to the next is that side chain. The carboxyl group, the amino group, and the alpha carbon, of course, are identical in every single amino acid. And again, just, yeah, it's good, useful to use the right words. You know, we could talk about the amino group being a moiety, and we could talk about the carboxyl group being a moiety. Remember that a moiety is sort of part of a molecule that we can recognize as also existing in other molecules. You can look in other molecules and you'll see carboxyl groups in them as well. So we can refer to that as a moiety, sort of like a separate identifiable section of the amino acid molecule. All right, so let me just recap what we've just seen so far. Every amino acid has an alpha carbon with a carboxyl group, an amino group, and one of 20 different side chains, and each of those side chains has different chemical properties. All right, the amino acids, because of course a polypeptide is a chain of amino acids, a polymer of amino acids. To become a chain, obviously, they need to be joined together, and they're joined together by a bond called a peptide bond. Now, a peptide bond is a covalent bond. That is, they're held together by sharing electrons, and it's a strong bond. We talked about that in the last episode, so if you didn't listen to the last episode, it's probably worth listening to that one first. So it is a covalent bond. When we talk about it being a peptide bond, that's a word that describes what is bonded to what, two amino acids bonded to each other, as opposed to how they're bonded, which is a covalent bond. All right. Also, the bond, we could use a couple of other words to describe it as well. We could say that it's a dehydration bond, because the way that a peptide bond is formed is that a hydrogen breaks off the amino group of one amino acid, and an oxygen and a hydrogen break off the carboxyl group of another amino acid, and together they form water, because an oxygen and a hydrogen plus a hydrogen makes one oxygen and two hydrogens, or H2O. And because water is being formed, or water is being lost from the molecule, if you like to think of it that way, we can call it a dehydration bond, because dehydration means losing water. Okay. By the way, an OH group, oxygen and hydrogen, if you want a name to describe that, I wonder if you can guess what that would be. Okay. Remember, a carboxyl group is a group that has carbon and oxygen in it. What do you reckon you'd call a group that has an oxygen and a hydrogen? Well, if you guessed hydroxyl, congratulations, you're right. A hydroxyl group is an oxygen with a hydrogen on it. So we could restate what we just said. A hydroxyl breaks off the carboxyl of one amino acid, and a hydrogen breaks off the amino group of the other amino acid. Together, they form H2O, water, and a covalent bond forms between those two amino acids. Now, of course, those two amino acids have both lost a little bit of themselves, haven't they? They've both lost something of themselves. One of them lost, you know, an oxygen and a hydrogen. The other lost a hydrogen. So what we're left with is something slightly smaller. If you've got a chain of amino acids, it's smaller than the sum of the amino acids that were used to make it, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, if you get 5 Lego bricks and you join them together, you've got a structure made of 5 Lego bricks, and that structure has the same amount of Lego as the 5 Lego bricks had separately. But if you get 5 amino acids and you join them together by peptide bonds, the structure that you end up with is a little bit smaller than the sum of the 5 amino acids, because each amino acid has lost oxygen and hydrogen at the other end. So the amino acids now are smaller than they used to be. And for that reason, we can say that a peptide bond is also a condensation bond. And we can call the whole process of joining these amino acids together to make a polymer, we can call it condensation polymerization. That's easy for me to say. Condensation polymerization. Because we're making a polymer it's a condensed molecule. So when we say it's condensation, you know, people get confused about this, or they're wrong about it, actually. I hear a lot of people saying that it's called condensation because water is lost, okay? But no, it's called dehydration because water is lost. It's called condensation because the molecule we end up with is smaller than the sum of the molecules that it's made from. Okay, in other words, we end up with a condensed molecule. It's exactly the same reason that we call, you know, like some dictionaries are called a condensed, like the condensed Oxford Dictionary, is because somebody took the Oxford Dictionary, which is too big to carry around because it's got too many words in it. They've cut a whole lot of words out that nobody uses anyway to make the book smaller so you can stick it in your school bag and take it to school. It's a condensed dictionary. It's made smaller by cutting things out of it. A polypeptide is smaller than the amino acids that it's made from because bits have been cut off. It's a condensed molecule. So we can call the process of joining them together condensation polymerization. Amino acid condensation polymerization. Kind of cool, isn't it? Don't you think? Beautiful. And one other word that I'm going to introduce to you, because again, it's useful if you're doing a SAC or something like that and you're writing about amino acids, it's just so much cooler to use the right terminology rather than just describing things. When we've got a polymer of amino acids, or a polypeptide, the amino acids in that polymer technically are not amino acids anymore, right? Because they've lost bits of themselves. We now call them amino acid residues. Okay, so if we wanted to be really, really precise, we wanted to be, our language to be really awesome, what we'd do is we would say that a polypeptide is a polymer of amino acid residues. I love that. Okay, fantastic. All right, so that brings us to the word proteome. Okay, now we've already said that protein is a sort of a functional word. It tells us that these proteins do lots of different jobs. And the proteome, this word proteome, is all the proteins in the body. The interesting thing about the proteome is that it's about 10 times bigger than the genome. Of course, the genome is all the genes that we have, right? So in a cell or in an organism is called that cell or that organism's genome. The proteome is about 10 times bigger. You know, in a human, we have about 20,000 genes in our genome, but we have 200,000 proteins in our proteome. Well, how is that possible? Because as we said before, DNA is the instructions for making proteins. So how can we end up with more proteins than we have genes? That's like saying we end up with more cakes than we have recipes to make the cakes. Well, that's where that cake metaphor doesn't really work, because each recipe is the recipe for making a cake. The chocolate cake recipe is a recipe for making chocolate cake. The vanilla slice recipe is the recipe for making vanilla slices, and so on. But when it comes to genes and proteins, it's a little bit different to that. Because on average, each gene encodes 10 different functional proteins. Now, having said that, typically a gene encodes a single polypeptide. But what happens to that polypeptide can differ depending on what cell it's in, depending on the time, you know, what other things are happening in the cell at the time. Things can happen to modify the polypeptide, turning it into a different functional protein. So you understand this, that, you know, the instructions for making the polypeptide are pretty much set. There's coded instructions for making a polypeptide. But once we've got that polypeptide, the polypeptide then has to be changed in some way to make it into a functional protein that does the job of that protein, whatever enzyme it might be, or antibody, or carrier protein. That the polypeptide has to be changed to make it into a functional protein. And it can be changed in a number of different ways, 10 different ways on average. Let's talk about some of the ways that that can happen. There are other proteins in a cell called chaperone proteins. And when the polypeptide is produced, and of course, polypeptides are produced at a ribosome. So when the polypeptide is produced by the ribosome, these chaperone proteins take that polypeptide, bend it, and fold it into a precise three-dimensional shape. Okay, that's one way. And of course, depending on what chaperone proteins are there, the same polypeptide might be bent and folded into a different conformation and end up being a different protein. How cool is that, though? Don't you think that's amazing? Especially when you consider, if I blow your mind here for a minute, especially if you consider that those chaperone proteins themselves are proteins. So when those proteins were produced, there were chaperone proteins that bent and folded them to become chaperone proteins, and now they are acting to bend and fold other proteins. I mean, it's you know, mind-blowing, isn't it, just to think about this. Other ways that a polypeptide can be modified to become a final functional protein is that things can be added to the polypeptide. Methyl groups can be added, for example. We call that methylation. Acetyl groups can be added. We call that acetylation. You know, and you don't probably really need to remember these words, but it's useful, I mean, to know them, right? It's useful to understand that stuff can be added onto the polypeptide, and you've got this chain of amino acids, but if you add stuff to it, you end up with a protein that is different now, right? It's had things done to it. Metals can be added to it. And a good example of that is hemoglobin, the protein that carries oxygen around our body. The protein in red blood cells that carries oxygen is called hemoglobin, and it has four polypeptides, and they have a heme group in them containing iron, the metal iron. All right, so that iron has been added, and that makes it into a different functional protein. And I've already said it, that, you know, some polypeptides, like hemoglobin, are made of more than one polypeptide. So you've got four different polypeptides. They all get combined together to make one functional protein. That's another way that polypeptides can be modified to make different proteins. And some polypeptides get cut by enzymes called proteases. The proteases cut the end, they cut the polypeptide so that we start off with one polypeptide and we might end up with two different polypeptides doing different jobs, you know, become different functional proteins because the one polypeptide gets cut in different places to make, you know, different proteins. All right, so all of those things can happen, and that's why for each gene, on average, there are 20 different functional proteins, because the one polypeptide can be produced and then modified in all these different ways. We call that post-translational modification. And the reason we call it that, post means after, translation is the process that happens in a ribosome to make a polypeptide. Okay, so translation happens to make the polypeptide, then after that, post that, there are modifications. It's post-translational modification. Chaperone proteins bending and folding the polypeptide, methyl groups being added, acetyl groups being added, proteases cutting the polypeptide, metals being added. And of course, all those things being added, like if a methyl group is added, guess who adds it? Can you guess? Well, if you guessed an enzyme, you are right. So now we've got a protein adding methyl groups to another protein to change its function. Isn't that fantastic? Makes your head just spin around on your shoulders, doesn't it? Thinking about proteins modifying other proteins, but those proteins themselves were modified by other proteins that were modified by other proteins. I mean, it's very meta. All right, fantastic. Well, let's go back and talk about the levels of protein structure. We've actually, believe it or not, started talking about it already. We talk about proteins having primary, secondary, tertiary, and sometimes quaternary structure as well. Primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary structure. Well, what does that mean? Firstly, can I say I think that this is really strange, weird, almost inaccurate terminology because it suggests that they're sequential, right? So when you go to primary school, then you leave primary school and you go to secondary school. And when you're in secondary school, you're no longer in primary school, but you're not yet in tertiary education. When you go to uni, you're now a tertiary student. You're no longer a secondary student, and you're certainly no longer a primary student. You leave primary and secondary education and go into tertiary education. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, they're sequential. That's what we mean. But proteins are not quite like that, because a protein that has tertiary structure still has secondary structure, and it still has primary structure too. It doesn't lose primary structure when it gets secondary structure. So what do these things even mean? As I said, I think a better way of thinking about them in terms of rather than call, and we call them levels of structure, but rather than calling them levels of structure, call them that, but think about them as being qualities of the protein. Okay, so the terminology dictates that we call them levels of structure, but in your mind, be thinking of them as qualities of protein structure rather than levels of protein structure. All right, well, primary structure, what does that mean? Primary structure is simply the sequence of amino acids. Remember, we said there are 20 different naturally occurring amino acids. They all get linked together by peptide bonds to form a polypeptide. Well, the sequence of those amino acids, that's what we mean by primary structure. In other words, primary structure is really just a list of amino acids. That's what it is. It's a list of amino acids. So serine, lysine, glutamic acid, tryptophan, lysine, serine, lysine, tryptophan, you know, phenylalanine. It's just a list of the different amino acids. That's the primary structure. The secondary structure of a protein is the way that the polypeptide chain naturally or natively tends to fold and bend because of the interaction of neighboring side chains. Remember, we said some side chains are electrically positive and some are electrically negative. Well, two electrically negative side chains are going to repel each other, but an electrically negative and an electrically positive side chain will attract each other. And then remember that some side chains are polar and some are nonpolar. Well, polar molecules tend to attract each other but repel nonpolar molecules. So again, depending on the the sequence of amino acids, the whole polypeptide is going to bend and fold in all kinds of ways. And some of those coils are just going to be random coils, as you know, maybe two electrically positive side chains bend to get as far away from each other as possible. It's just a random coil, or where you might get two polar side chains that are attracted to each other, and so it bends the chain and it folds in that way so they can be as close to each other as possible. So there's all sorts of random coils. But there are two very common, we call them motifs, that's M-O-T-I-F, two common motifs of secondary structure that you should be aware of. The first of those is an alpha helix, and the plural of that is alpha helices. And an alpha helix is a very common motif in secondary structure. And it's where the carboxyl group of one amino acid forms a hydrogen bond with the amino group of another amino acid four amino acids further down the polypeptide chain. And that sort of pulls them into a kind of a corkscrew shape where there's about 3.6 amino acids per turn. All right, if you can kind of picture that happening. And so it's held together by these hydrogen bonds between one amino acid and an amino acid four amino acids further down the polypeptide. If you can kind of picture that happening, that we call an alpha helix, that sort of corkscrew-shaped, curled ribbon-shaped shape, folding shape within that polypeptide chain, an alpha helix. A beta-pleated sheet, on the other hand, is where you have the polypeptide chain perhaps goes, if you're sort of trying to picture it, from left to right, then turns around like a hairpin and goes back right to left, then turns around and goes back left to right again. And as it does, hydrogen bonds form between adjacent amino groups and carboxyl groups, and the side chains either stick up or stick down. So it sort of takes on a kind of a like a corrugated iron appearance, sort of, you know, up and down and up and down, or corrugated cardboard appearance. And we call that a beta pleated sheet. Okay. So two, and again, that's a very common motif that you'll see in polypeptides, in the secondary structure of proteins. When you're looking at a picture of a protein, very often the beta-pleated sheets are represented by a flat arrow. Now, you'll see this chain, this line that represents the polypeptide chain, and then it broadens out into this flat arrow. That arrow represents the beta-pleated sheet. Okay, so again, just good to be aware of that. And we also talk about, you know, the difference, and you'll see this often. If you're reading about beta-pleated sheets, you'll see people talking about things like the N-terminus and the C-terminus. And if you find that confusing, well, don't be confused. It's actually pretty common, straightforward. The C-terminus refers to the end of the polypeptide chain that has the carboxyl of that amino acid at the end, and the N-terminus refers to the end of the polypeptide that has an exposed amino group. Okay, so the N standing for nitrogen, all right? So if you have, you know, four people all holding hands, that whole group is going to have a left-hand end and a right-hand end. You know, at one end of that group of four people, there'll be a right hand that's exposed, and at the other end, there'll be a left hand that's exposed. Same with the N-terminus and the C-terminus of a polypeptide chain. One end is going to have an exposed carboxyl group, that's the C-terminus. The other hand will have an exposed nitrogen or amino group, and that is the N-terminus. So again, you know, and I would recommend, go and have a look at a diagram, because it's actually kind of hard to describe a beta-pleated sheet in words. It's a lot easier to do it with a diagram, which of course I don't have access to doing here in the podcast. So my advice would be actually probably pause right here, just go to Wikipedia or something, look at Google beta-pleated sheet, and you'll see a diagram in Google Images, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's not as hard as I'm probably making it sound. All right, very good. So that's what we mean by secondary structure. And the secondary structure, whatever it is, that random coils, alpha helices, beta-pleated sheets, the secondary structure of the protein is largely held in place by hydrogen bonds, but also sometimes where two sulfurs come together. And there are two amino acids that contain sulfur. They're methionine and cysteine. I don't think you probably really need to remember that. But cysteine especially, where two cysteine amino acid side chains come against each other, what they'll do is they will form a bond between them called a disulfide bond. That's a covalent bond. They're sharing electrons. We call it a disulfide bond. That's a word that tells us who is bonded to who or what is bonded to what. A sulfur to a sulfur, disulfide. But it is a covalent bond. But that's a much stronger bond than a hydrogen bond. And it does a good job of holding that polypeptide in its shape. All right. But largely, certainly alpha helices and beta pleated sheets are held in shape by hydrogen bonds, which are relatively weak. All right, the tertiary structure of a protein is really a description of the shape of the protein and the three-dimensional shape of the protein. And people get confused at this point because they say, well, what about an alpha helix? An alpha helix is a three-dimensional shape. It has length, it has width, it has depth. Why is an alpha helix, if it's a corkscrew shaped, why is that not tertiary structure because it's three-dimensional shape, right? Well, it is, but when we talk about the tertiary structure of a protein, we're talking about the overall outside three-dimensional shape of the protein. So, you know, for example, do you remember when you were a kid and you were at primary school? Maybe. Maybe you did it last week. I don't know. But you get plaster of Paris and these strips of stuff, and you make like a plaster cast of your face. Have you ever done that? And then you let it dry a bit and you take it off and you've got like a cast of your face with your nose shape and your eyebrow shape. And, you know, it's basically just a cast, well, of your face, right? Well, what you've got there is a cast, if you like, of the tertiary structure of your face. All right. Now, of course, inside your head, you've got a brain that's got three dimensions. You've got nasal cavities with three dimensions and stuff. But when we're talking about the tertiary structure of a protein, it's kind of like the face of the protein. It's the outside shape of the protein, which is really important because it's that outside shape of the protein that determines how that protein is going to interact with other molecules. Let me say that again because it's just so incredibly important. Remember we talked about how proteins are so important? You know, antibodies are really important. Carrier proteins are really important. Antigens are really important. All these proteins, enzymes, really, really important. What it is that determines the job they do, the function that they serve, is the shape, that outer shape of the protein. Proteins will bind to other proteins if they have a complementary shape. So the shape of a protein is just incredibly important to its function. An antibody, for example, will only stick on an antigen if the antigen binding site of the antibody has the right exact shape. An enzyme will only bind to the substrate, to the molecule that it works on, if the enzyme has an active site with the exact shape to fit that substrate. Okay, a carrier protein that moves things through a membrane will only move something through the membrane if that something can bind to something on the carrier protein that's exactly the right shape. That outer shape, the surface shape of a protein, incredibly important to its function. And that's what we talk about when we're talking about the tertiary structure of the protein. Sure, inside the protein, there are alpha helices that are three-dimensional shapes and beta pleated sheets that have three-dimensional shapes and, you know, random coils that have three-dimensional shapes. But that's not what we mean by tertiary structure. It's that outer surface shape that we refer to as tertiary structure. And if a protein has quaternary structure, and not all proteins do, but if a protein has quaternary structure, all that means is that that protein is made of more than one polypeptide chain. Okay, remember, some proteins are only made of a single polypeptide chain. They don't have quaternary structure. They'll have tertiary structure, secondary structure, and primary structure, but a protein will only have quaternary structure if it's made of more than one polypeptide, two or more polypeptides stuck together, you know, wound around each other, but together functioning as a single functional unit. So hemoglobin, for example, that protein in our red blood cells that carries oxygen around our body, we mentioned before, has four separate polypeptide chains. So hemoglobin has quaternary structure. Antibodies have four separate polypeptide chains, two long ones and two short ones. So an antibody has quaternary structure. Okay, but not all proteins do. Two other words that you'll hear people using to describe proteins are globular proteins and fibrous proteins. Globular and fibrous. Now, the word globular, it sounds fun, doesn't it? Glob. Glob. Anyway, it sounds like a funny word, but it's referring like globe. Like if you think about on your desk, you might have a model of the Earth, and we refer to that as a globe of the Earth. Sort of round, three-dimensional is what the word globular means, like a globe. Many proteins are globular proteins. Antibodies are globular proteins. Enzymes are globular proteins. Carrier proteins and channel proteins, globular proteins. They're sort of proteins that are sort of rounded. They've got three-dimensional shape, you know. So we call them globular proteins. But some proteins we refer to as fibrous proteins. They tend to be very, very long and just like a whole lot of proteins all linked together into a long, thin fiber. So some good examples are things like keratin, which is the protein that your hair and fingernails is made of. That is a fibrous protein, these long, thin proteins. Collagen, which is a protein that gives your skin structure, is a fibrous protein. Actin and myosin are fibrous proteins. They're the proteins responsible for muscle contraction, okay? And also inside a cell, I'm sure you've learned about the cytoskeleton of a cell, these long, thin fibers that hold the cell in shape. And also they are responsible for, in mitosis, when that spindle forms, you get those spindle fibers extending across the cell, those are actin fibers as well. And so, you know, those, and if you do PE, I'm sure you've learned about actin and myosin, they're fibrous proteins. So, you know, they're not sort of rounded with active sites and stuff. They're just long. They tend to have a structural function in the body, you know, so they tend to be, as I said, muscle fibers, the cytoskeleton of the cell, hair, fingernails, those types of things. All right, so I just wanted to introduce those terms to you. And the last thing that I want to do in this episode of Dauchi's Biology is to mention a couple of words that we use when we're describing proteins. And you've come across these already. We actually mentioned them in the last episode, but, you know, mentioning them a couple of times isn't going to hurt. In fact, it's probably very beneficial. The first thing I want to say is that many proteins end in the word in, I-N, the term that suffix IN is very common for a protein. And in fact, in the last few sentences, I've mentioned a number of them, right? Keratin is the protein of which hair and fingernails is made. We talked about actin and myosin, for example, two other fibrous proteins. So a lot of proteins, their names end in IN. And if that protein is an enzyme, and it's worth saying that all enzymes are proteins. Lots of proteins are other things, but of course, all enzymes are proteins. The ending A's, A-S-E, tells you that it's an enzyme. It's an enzyme ending. And then there are some enzymes that don't end in A's, like, for example, pepsin in your stomach. Okay, which ends in IN, not A's, still a protein. And I think it was just named before this convention came in. But these days, pretty much every enzyme ends in the word A, or ends in that those three letters A's. You know, if you've learned about the trip operon, which you may well have learned about by this stage of the year, you will have read about tryptophan synthase, and for that matter, anthranilate synthase and indole-3-glycerol phosphate synthase. See, they all end in A's. You will have learned in the trip operon that the DNA is transcribed into RNA by an enzyme called RNA polymerase. Okay, again, it ends in that A's ending. And already in this episode, we've talked about how when a polypeptide is modified to make different functional proteins, sometimes the polypeptide is cut by enzymes called proteases. Okay, and often these enzymes are named incredibly logically. Like, just think about how logically, like, it's so easy to remember. Like, RNA polymerase is an enzyme, that's the A's bit, that makes an RNA polymer. It's an RNA polymerase. It joins amino acids together, joins nucleotides together to make RNA. Okay, indole-3-glycerol phosphate synthase is an enzyme that synthesizes indole-3-glycerol phosphate. Anthranilate synthase is an enzyme that synthesizes anthranilate. You know, the name of an enzyme typically tells you what job it does with the ending A's at the end of it. Well, that's all the things that I feel like telling you about proteins for now. But we're not going to forget about proteins. In fact, right through the year, all through Unit 3 and 4 Biology, we're going to be coming back and talking about proteins from time to time because so many of the processes that we're going to be learning about involve proteins. And so it's such an important topic. So you, again, may want to listen to this several times. Make sure you've got all those terms and definitions and understandings, you know, in your mind. You want to keep them there fresh in your mind as you go through the rest of the course. If you have a question or a comment, something you want to ask about this or any other episode of the podcast, please feel free to send me an email, and you can do that to biologypodcast@gmail.com. And if you do that, I'll discuss your question on the next episode of the podcast. You can be completely anonymous. I'll only mention you by first name anyway, so no one will know who you are. But that'd be great. You know, if you ask a question, probably the question that you ask is a question that lots of other people were thinking to ask as well. So I'd really appreciate it if you do that. But whether or not you do, I'll see you back here in the next episode, and we'll be talking about nucleic acids. So join me back here again. Thanks for listening.